Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the History Hit World Wars podcast. If it's your first time here, we are dedicated to that turbulent period in history between 1914 and 1945. And so if you're passionate about that period of history, then please like, follow, subscribe and share to anyone and everyone that you think will listen. You can follow along online on Twitter at HistoryHitWW2 and on Instagram at JamesRogersHistory. Now, every now and then in the World Wars, we dig back through the back catalogue of Dan Snow's History Hit, and we find those episodes that need a bit more attention once again. In this episode, we're looking at the life of a navigator during World War II. Now, this is with Arthur Spence, who was a navigator during the Second World War. He completed two tours of operations with 97 Squadron at RAF Woodall Spa and RAF Bourne, and he was awarded the Legion d'Honneur for providing services to the resistance. Dan met with him at his house, and they discussed life during the war, the hardship of losing good friends, and whether or not he felt guilt about the bombing raids he took part in. You're going to love this one. It is fascinating. It is a lived history that illuminates that period of the Second World War. So enjoy.
Name's Arthur Spencer. I started 43 as a sergeant, 1311996. I was commissioned in the summer 145359, and I spent from January 43 till September 43 navigating Lancaster, mainly Lancaster OF, which stood for 97 Squadron, J. Johnny. I crewed up with a young 19-year-old Canadian. I think it would be worth telling you an anecdote about crewing up as well. I had a close friend. We'd trained together and boastings had kept us together for quite a while, and we finished up at the same OTU. And we'd only been there a couple of days, and he said, "I've got myself a pilot." And I said, "Well, you were very quick off the mark," because we had 4 weeks, 6 weeks, I think, to crew up. And he said, "Yes." And he'd found an American who'd gone north of the border and joined the Canadian Air Force. And so I sought out this American pilot, larger-than-life American, enormous chap. And I said, "I hear you've got yourself a navigator. Can you recommend a pilot?" And he thought hard for a moment and he said, "Well, I reckon young Jimmy Munro is one of the best pilots on our course." And at the next opportunity, I sought out Jimmy Munro and said, "Have you got a navigator yet?" He said, "No." So we crewed up together, and that's probably the reason I'm still here today.
Tell me about how close your crew got over the course of your sorties above occupied Europe.
Well, very close indeed. We socialised together so much. When we were at Woodhall Spa, most of the nights we weren't flying, we would go to the local pub, the Leagate, and we did everything together, really. Two of the crew, the wireless operator and the engineer, decided they'd had enough at 30 and left the crew, but they were...
And just explain to everyone, what does having enough at 30 mean?
Well, 30 operations was a tour, and if you were in main force, you did 30, and then you had at least 6 months, in inverted commas, rest, and then came back and did a second tour, though some people who adapted well to being instructors, no doubt, never came back, and you did a second tour of 20, so you did 50 altogether. After you'd done two tours, the Air Force said you'd done enough. But there was a slightly different situation in Pathfinder Force. You did 30, and by that time you were in a very experienced crew, of course, and they didn't want to break up an experienced crew. So they gave you 3 weeks leave, and to recompense for having only 3 weeks leave instead of at least a 6 month rest, you only did 15 in the second tour. So you did 45 trips altogether.
In your experience of the crews you started with, how many of them survived all of those trips?
it's very surprising, but three crews went from the heavy bomber conversion unit at Swinderby to 97 Squadron, and all three survived. But for some reason, a little while ago, I totted up how many crews had been lost on the operations I'd been on, and I was amazed. It was 795. So I was very lucky to survive, really.
Were you aware of how dangerous it was at the time?
Well, sometimes losses were quite heavy. There were occasions when the squadron lost two crews, and others when they lost, quite a few others when they lost one crew. So, yes, I was aware that. I thought after landing after the 45th operation, I thought, well, the chances of me being alive at the end of the war are far greater now than they were yesterday. Because the last three of the last five trips were all to Berlin, so which was a bit hairy.
I'll bet it was. Can you talk me through preparing for one of those trips and going on one of those? Let's take a Berlin trip, for example. When did you hear about it? How long did you have to prepare yourself? And talk me through how the trip unfolded.
Well, the day on a bomber squadron didn't start very early because we were flying at night. So about 9:30 in the morning, the crew would report to, well, the captain would go and report the crew were all available, report to the flight commander. No one would worry if you didn't report till 10 o'clock, but if it got to 10:15 and you hadn't reported in, someone might ask where you were. Then you went off and did an air test. And either just before the air test or during the air test, a document was published called the Order of Battle, which wasn't particularly interesting because it merely listed the aircraft and listed all the crews taking part with every member of crew listed. But what was interesting always was the petrol load and the bomb load at the bottom, because this was didn't tell you the target, but it gave you an idea of how far you were going to go. A big petrol load and a small bomb load probably meant Italy or somewhere a long way into Germany. A big bomb load and a small petrol load almost inevitably meant the Ruhr, of course, or possibly one of the French ports. Somewhere in between would have meant a target somewhere in between Nuremberg, Munich, Hamburg, something like that. So you went off and did your air test, about 20 minutes, half an hour. The pilot would throw the aircraft around the sky a bit to make sure all the controls worked. Each member of crew would check their equipment. The gunners would rotate their turrets, though they wouldn't fire their guns. The bomb aimer would check his bomb sight and the front turret, because he was the front gunner. The wireless operator would send and receive a short message. I would check my compasses and other instruments, and particularly my radar. And after 20 minutes, half an hour, back to base. By the time we'd got rid of our parachute and harness and so on, it was time for lunch and briefing early in the afternoon, 2:30, and that was when you really heard the target, to be sure of it. The navigator had to draw up his flight plan based on the winds provided by the Met officer. And, well, in the winter when night was early, we'd have a quick meal and report back for takeoff, collect parachutes, go to the crew room, put on Mae West and harness, and out to the aircraft and a chat with the ground crew, a pee over the rear wheel of the Lancaster, and off we went.
All that waiting time, that preparation time, did you have a gnawing anxiety, or did you just get used to it and you're just cracking on?
I think you were too busy, really, to be anxious. I mean, obviously you knew that you were taking a risk, but there was war on. In the summer, there was a longer waiting period, of course, because you didn't take off till perhaps half past 8, 9 o'clock. In fact, when we did the long trip through to the shuttle service operation, I noticed we didn't take off till 9:40, which British summer time, of course. So, but it wasn't healthy to be over the French or the Dutch coast in daylight. So,
and taking off as a navigator, that must have been a fearsome challenge. I always think it's remarkable that the navigation alone is quite challenging on these things, let alone dealing with dropping bombs and enemy interdiction.
Yes, I was busy all the time, of course. We used to initially climb to 20,000 feet over base before we set course, the idea being that the Germans wouldn't know which direction you were going until the last minute. If you were climbing on route, you were flying more slowly so they would get an idea earlier and have more time for preparation. You'd fly out across the North Sea, either crossing the coast. Well, if we're going to Berlin, you might cross it in Holland and go straight across the continent, or cross into Denmark somewhere and then fly south to Berlin. It took about 3 hours to get to Berlin.
Would there be chat over the intercom?
Oh, yes. Not unnecessary chatter, but, you know, one of the gunners might call up, there's an aircraft out on our port quarter. I can't identify it, but I'll keep an eye on it. Two or three occasions we were coned, which is a most unpleasant experience, far worse than being chased by a fighter.
What does coned mean?
Coned by searchlights. A master blue searchlight might latch upon you, and then a cone of searchlights would pick you out in the sky. And at 20,000 feet, of course, the cone is quite big. It's difficult to get out of. And sometimes you could hear the flak bursting, which meant it was fairly close to you. And sometimes you'd hear shrapnel rattling along the fuselage of the aircraft. But we didn't have that much trouble, but just occasionally. I can recall one occasion we had when we were quite an experienced crew, two or three occasions, you take a novice pilot along with you, and we were going east somewhere over northern Germany, somewhere south of Bremen, I should think. And Jimmy said to this South African pilot, "Now watch this." And he stayed straight and level longer than he would normally have done. And then he turned off. And almost immediately, there were three bursts of flak just where we would have been if we'd have carried straight on. And to have the confidence to do that was quite surprising. And on one occasion, there was a young fighter pilot came to spend his week's leave with the squadron. And he came on three operations with us. That's not my idea of a week's leave, but and at the end of the week, we took him back to his base, Twinwoods, in Bedford somewhere, with a runway of only 800 yards because he was on bow fighters. And we took him back, and it was quite a short run to get a Lancaster off. And I think Jimmy got his knuckles wrapped for doing it when we got back to base. But you can't do much to a chap who's done 40 operations.
Is there anywhere where you just dreaded going?
Well, Berlin was, I suppose, the most worrying target, because you were over occupied territory for so long. You were over Germany. If you went to the Ruhr, 3.5 hours there and back, in and out, very heavily defended, of course, but you weren't there very long, whereas flying to Berlin, you were over occupied territory a long time. When we went to Peenemünde, we just had the four big raids on Hamburg. We missed the first one because we were on leave. But we realised, everyone in Bomber Command realised after the Hamburg attacks, that Butch Harris's next priority would be Berlin. And we got to the middle of August, full moon, and when the order of battle, which I mentioned before, was published, the petrol and bomb load looked exactly right for Berlin. And morale went down a bit. You could almost feel it, that Berlin on a night of a full moon, what's he thinking of? It'll be a massacre of Bomber Command. Because normally we didn't operate by that time in the full moon. But when we got to briefing, we found that we were going to Peenemünde, but it was exactly the same bomb load and fuel load as Berlin would have been.
As you're over enemy territory, did it help that you were so busy you didn't have much time to think? But do you think the other crew, some of the gunners and things, might have been pretty scary, just spending hours traipsing over enemy territory?
Well, they were rotating their turrets, looking out for enemy aircraft. They were busy all the time, and even on the way back, when the rest of us could relax a bit, we'd get down below 8,000 feet so we could take our oxygen masks off over the North Sea and have some coffee, and the wireless operator would get a bit of light music on the radio and so on. But even then, the gunners were instructed to keep rotating their turrets and keeping a lookout. In fact, just after I left the squadron, one of the pilots was shot down somewhere north of Bourne by an intruder. He survived, and most of his crew survived, but I think two of them were killed. And so you kept alert even though when you were back over England.
When you were over Germany, what did you fear the most, enemy fighters or enemy anti-aircraft fire from the ground?
Well, fighters were probably more dangerous, but we only had one serious encounter with a fighter in 45 operations, whereas we were being fired at pretty well all the time, of course.
Tell me about the encounter with the fighter.
Well, there was a sudden scream from the rear gunner, turn the port and dive, and immediately the Lank was more or less over on its back, diving away, and both the gunners were firing. You could hear the guns going, the plane filled with the smell of cordite, and he followed us a little way, but he must have lost us, and that was it. It was all over in a matter of half a minute. I know, I can remember, my parachute used to be an elastic cord over it against the fuselage. Now, I looked around to make sure my parachute was in the right place, but fortunately, there was no need for it. And I think possibly an inexperienced German fighter, because he lost us and didn't come back for a second go.
And then when you were in the area in which you wanted to drop the bombs, how did those minutes and seconds work?
Well, once the bomb aimer could see the target, which was normally target indicators, of course, my job was finished.
And what are target indicators? They're flares, are they?
They were like rockets that would burst barometrically at 3,000 feet. And they'd only burn for about 6 minutes and hang there, so they had to be backed up all the time. And once the bomb aimer could see these target indicators, my job was finished. I would give the pilot the course out of the target so that he was ready to turn away. The bomb aimer, left, left, right, right, steady, steady. There's an old joke about bomb aimers, of course, left, left, right, right, back a bit, back a bit. But then when he was satisfied that the target was in his bomb sight, he would press the tit and the bombs would drop one after the other. And then you had to fly absolutely straight and level for 25 seconds until a photograph was taken. A flash went down and a photograph was taken. That 25 seconds seemed a long time. And once it was over and the photo was taken, you would turn away from the target and take the course home.
What was the feeling like in the crew when the bombs went and you'd completed that 25 seconds?
I always felt very relieved because you were carrying so much less weight and you could almost feel the plane lift as the bombs dropped. And you knew that the worst was over, really. You were on your way home. Though, in fact, I think more aircraft were lost on their way home than on their way to the target. But it was a nice feeling that at least the bombs couldn't blow up.
What was your visibility like? Could you see the bombs impacting on the ground? Could you see other aircraft in the formation?
Well, we weren't in formation, of course, like the Lanks were. We were just a loose gaggle. The last trip I did, 300 Lanks went across Berlin in about 20 minutes. So that gives you an idea of what, about 15 a minute going through the target. The Hamburg raids, there were about 800 in about 40 minutes. So about 20 a minute going through the target. Over the Ruhr, there was a terrific lot of industrial haze. And I think we did 18 trips to the Ruhr and only saw the ground twice. But you saw these target indicators bursting, hopefully over the target. When we went to on this shuttle service trip to Friedrichshafen, you could actually see the first green TI right over the Zeppelin factory. And there you could really see what was going on.
And how about other aircraft, though? Did you ever see them shot down?
Oh, yes. You often saw other aircraft shot down. One I remember particularly, on the Peenemünde raid, we crossed the North Sea about an hour and 10 minutes. And as we were approaching the coast of Denmark, there was a lot of activity over on our starboard and searchlights and so on, and firing started. And then an aircraft was obviously coned. And
what kind of aircraft?
Well, it was a four-engine bomber. We wouldn't know. It was some distance from us. I found out after it was a Halifax, but it blew up and burning bits fell down into the sea. And obviously one felt sorry for these chaps, but I'm afraid my first thought was, what a rotten bit of navigation, because if he's somewhere in front of us, he's almost certainly another Pathfinder crew, and he was. And we're supposed to be experts in navigation. And there he was, 20 miles south of track, over a heavily defended area, when he needn't be over a defended area at all. I mean, obviously, if you went to the Ruhr, the target was defended, you had to go through defences. But to go through a heavily defended area unnecessarily, well, he wasn't doing his job properly.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Is it possible to say how many of these aircraft losses were down to pilot navigation error or technical error, and how many just absolute the luck of the draw?
I don't know that one could have any idea of that. On the last of the big hamburger operations, the weather was very, very bad. There were storms all over Northern Europe, and we were icing up quite badly. And I'm sure that night some losses were due to bad weather, but most frequently, I think they were due to enemy action.
But how vulnerable were you to that enemy action? I mean, would a really veteran crew, veteran pilot, be able to sort of reduce the exposure to the enemy if they really knew what they were doing?
I don't think he would, not over the target. I mean, one of our flight commanders, in fact, he was master of ceremonies, as he was called, over Berlin in one of our last, and a very, very experienced chap. But he was shot down on, I think it was our penultimate operation over Berlin. He lost, the aircraft blew up and he lost an arm and was repatriated through Switzerland under this exchange of injured military personnel scheme. And when I came back from Italy, I spent a couple of days at Pathfinder headquarters catching up with things, and he was there as an air staff officer, and we went out and had a drink together and had a chat about life on the squadron.
So any aircraft, any crew were vulnerable to being shot down by enemy action?
Probably people were most vulnerable in their first five or six trips. A lot of crews came, didn't last very long, but once they'd lasted five or six trips. So yes, obviously experience helped, but it didn't help if you got a direct hit on the aircraft, of course.
So you've dropped your bombs, you're heading back to the... You're listening to some music over the North Sea. A fairly good feeling?
Oh, yes, yeah. Nice cup of coffee and sandwich, a bar of chocolate, that sort of thing. Yeah, oh, yes. You've probably survived another one.
And then touching down in Lincolnshire must have felt even better.
Oh, yes, yeah, yes. Another anecdote, let me tell you. One day we couldn't do an air test first thing in the morning, as one normally did, because the ground crew were doing something to our aircraft. And by the time the aircraft was ready, all the WAFs who drove the wagons out to dispersal had disappeared for their lunch. And so the flight commander was there, and we said to him, well, is there transport about? Assuming he might ring up empty and get some transport. But he said, oh, my van's over there. I shan't be needing it for an hour. I'd take my van. And Jimmy, our 19-year-old pilot, said to him, I can't drive. And the flight commander turned to me and said, makes you realise, doesn't it, how long the war's been on. Here's this chap who's done 40-odd operations in a Lancaster and can't drive a car.
19 years old.
And, in fact, he didn't finish after two tours. There was no commitment to do anything further, but he didn't want to go and be an instructor. So he stayed on the squadron, and he was shot down on his 57th operation over Berlin. And... sad, really, that he'd done so many. Yes, yes. So the whole crew were on the Runnymede Memorial, you know, the memorial for people with no known grave. They never found the identity discs. He used to come home on leave with me occasionally, and my mother treated him like a second son. And she kept in touch with Jimmy's mother until they both died. And in fact, we're still in touch with one of his brothers and his sister-in-law. And they have stayed here with us, and we've stayed with them in Toronto.
What about those losses? I mean, every time I talk to your generation, you're so resilient. It must have been landing, hitting the ground. Did you ask each other immediately, right, who didn't come back last night?
Not immediately, no. You probably didn't find out till the next morning because you got rid of your parachute and your harness and so on, went and had eggs and bacon and went off to bed till... Well, most of the squadron, most of the crew used to sleep through till midday after an operation, but I can honestly say I never missed breakfast. I was just probably so hungry that... I wouldn't say I was the first in the mess to breakfast, but I'd get up about 8 o'clock and have a shower. I always have a shower because heavy bombers were fairly dirty things, and get into the mess for breakfast about 9 o'clock, just before 9 o'clock when breakfast finished, and then go and have a look at the results of the photographs were published, have a look at the photographs and find out how many crews had been lost. And
what happened when a crew that you knew, friends of yours, were lost? I mean, did you grieve, or was it just, did you accept it?
I think you accepted it, yes. I remember the first loss was a sergeant. After I joined the squadron, we, most of the sergeants, lived in a little plantation off the road between Woodhorse Bar and Coningsby, Nissen huts there. And at the end of the lane, there was a searchlight post. There were three all around the airfield and for airfield defence. And also, they would form a cone over the airfield when we were coming back at night. And this Canadian sergeant had got quite friendly with these gunners, Royal Artillery people, manning the searchlight post. And they were very upset indeed when he went missing after a trip to Essen. Probably more upset than the rest of us on the squadron. People, there was a war on and people did get lost, you know.
Did you think you were going to live?
I didn't really think I would survive two tours of operations, but... I was very lucky.
Did that not make you a bit upset, thinking, oh, I probably won't have kids, not going to get to marry anyone, not going to see the world?
I didn't think of it at the time, really. You just hoped you'd survive another operation, and if you did, it was a bonus.
That's a nice way to live, I suppose. You're always pleasantly surprised to see another day.
Yes, oh yeah, yes. Another day was always a good day.
Do you look back on that time with fondness?
Yes, I do, really. And it was the most interesting period of my life. I had a year in Florida, and I had a year in the Middle East. I wouldn't say with fondness, but as the most exciting and interesting period of my life, certainly.
And what about now with people arguing about how valuable your contribution to the war? How does that make you feel? Do you, when people now talk about the civilian casualties on the ground, the destruction of the cities of Europe, how do you respond to those sort of criticisms and arguments?
Well, after the fall of France, the bomber war was the only way we could attack Germany. There was no other way until the invasion. I think probably there were times when Butch Harris bombed cities rather than targets, but some of the cities in this country had been pretty badly bombed as well. And revenge isn't a very praiseworthy motive, but one didn't worry too much about what was happening on the ground.
Did that motivate you? When you were dropping bombs, did you think of Coventry and Southampton and London, Liverpool?
No, not really. No, that was all in the past. By that time, the Germans weren't able to attack England. And of course, while I was in Italy, the V2 attack started. Fortunately, about 3 months later than they might otherwise have done as a result of the Peenemünde raid, because if they'd been 3 months earlier, they'd have been exactly at the same time as the invasion. Invasion was June the 6th and the first V2 was September the 8th. So go back 3 months, and if they'd have been landing at the time of the invasion, one hesitates to think what would happen.
Thank you very much indeed. That was lovely.
Well, sorry about my throat. I was talking too much.
Thank you. When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
And before you go, remember, as a Warfare listener, you get a special discount at History Hit. Subscribers get access to blissfully uninterrupted ad-free podcasts and thousands of hours of history documentaries. You've got everything from the American Revolution to my own documentaries like Traces of War, Weapons of War, and 24 Hours in Normandy, where I follow in the footsteps of the Green Howards on D-Day, from their beach landings to being awarded the Victoria Cross, and all the way through their first day where they made it 7 miles inland, further than any other British or American unit. So head over to historyhit.com/subscribe or follow the link in the show notes and use the code WARFARE to get 50% off your next 3 months. That's the code WARFARE to get 50% off. And if you're an Apple listener, you can subscribe for new ad-free episodes within the app. So give it a go. I know you're gonna love it.